So, welcome to the Play Myself Show. I'm Miles. I'm here with Daniel, and we're going to talk Haiti. Just because my mom, Marie, she actually, Daniel's a high school friend of hers, and she kind of said, you know, if you, because I always call my mom about everything that's on my mind, and I'm like, all right, mom, I'm thinking about Haiti. And she's like, well, I'm going to put you through to a friend of mine that I think knows what you know and could educate you. And like, she knows that I'm always down for that. So this is awesome. So Daniel, tell us about yourself.
Well, I was born in Haiti, left Haiti at 9 years old in 1973, October 1973. So I've been here for 47 years, believe it or not. Seems like yesterday. And of course, since I left at 9 years old, there's, you know, so much you could learn, you know, by the age of nine. But almost everything I've known about Haiti, I've learned when I entered college. And since then, I've been reading a whole lot of books on Haiti. And I've learned, I guess, everything that I've known about Haiti in my adult life. And it always amazes me that the more I learn about Haiti, the more I start to understand the importance of the Haitian Revolution and all of the things that Haitian people have done. But my life, basically, I could say I'm an electrical engineer, been an electrical engineer now for the past 33 years. So I'm an electrical engineer, I'm a Freemason, an American veteran, a Marine, and always a proud Haitian. I'll be a proud Haitian till I die.
When we got to talking the other day, and what really made me interested about like doing this show is we kind of had a lot of the same perspective on, you know, maybe it was like the whole, like what was going on in American politics or whatever, but being Haitian, I've always took what happened in Haiti or what I thought what was going on in Haiti as it was supposed to happen. And then as I became older and I educated myself, I was like, man, like we kind of had it the way it should have been, but something else happened that kind of shifted the thought, whether it be in Haiti to Haitians or in America now to Haitian Americans. And it was something that I needed to dig into. Cause like I read about like Toussaint Louverture and Dasalim, and I'll go in on like, oh man, like how could these dudes be so smart and let this happen to them? And how does a nation become so crippled, but the first republic to ever stand in this hemisphere? You know?
Yep. And I think that part, that's something that a lot of people, even I would say, see, people in Haiti would know a lot about it, but a lot of people here and around the world may not know too much about because a lot of the history has been suppressed. Just, you know, to give a quick rundown, we know the Haitian Revolution took 13 years from 1791 to 1804. From the inception of the Haitian Revolution, Haiti, as small as it is, has always sought to make changes, not just in Haiti, but throughout the world. And the leaders of the Haitian Revolution have always said that this Haitian Revolution, we cannot keep it here in Haiti. We must spread this revolution throughout the world and free the rest of the world. Wherever there are enslaved people, it must be our goal to free those people. A lot of people have heard about Simon Bolivar, talk about the Bolivarian Revolution, but a lot of people don't really know the connection of Simon Bolivar to Haiti. Because in 1815, when Simon Bolivar wanted to free, this was 11 years after the Haitian Revolution ended, 1815, he wanted to free South America, which was then called Grand Granada. Wanted to free South America. He went there in 1815 to fight the Spanish in Cartagena. which is now part of Colombia. And he basically got his butt whipped. He lost to the Spanish. 1816, he went to Haiti to ask for help. And the president of Haiti gave him a place to stay, gave him refuge, and sent him back with more than 4,000 rifles, ammunition, and also skilled tacticians in warfare who had just fought the Haitian Revolution, sent him back to South America. He lost again. He came back to Haiti for the second time, requested for more help, so they gave him more arms, but this time gave him a lot of soldiers with more tacticians who went back to South America, and he was successful. Now, the Haitian president then said he only wants one thing in return. He said, every country that you free in South America, ensure that they abolish slavery. And Simon Bolivar kept his word. He freed six countries in South America and made sure that it is in their constitution, every country that was free, that they abolish slavery. So he freed Panama, Nicaragua. The first one that he freed was Venezuela, which is where he was from. Freed Venezuela, Panama, Colombia. Last one was Bolivia. And six countries. Honduras was one of them. And there's one more. The name will come back to me soon. But he made sure that in every single one of those countries, it is listed in the Constitution that as of today, slavery would be abolished. And that was one thing that America at that time wasn't too happy with, because even though the Spanish, they were competitors with America, but America still wasn't happy because slavery was still part of American life. So the news of this Haitian Revolution in Haiti, and then the Haitians had the audacity to spread it throughout the Americas, throughout South America, that news, they try to suppress it as much as they can. But the news still made it to America, because 7 years after the Haitian Revolution in 1811, you had what's called the German Coast Rebellion in Louisiana, which was started by Charles Deland, who was a Haitian enslaved person who was relocated to Louisiana, but he refused to remain a slave. So he started one of the largest revolutions that the Americas have ever seen.
I heard about that. Somebody snitched or something, right? What was it?
Like, what's that?
Somebody told, was that it? Like somebody told that, like what was going on, and then like they stopped it in like South Carolina or something like that?
Yes. Yep. And if you notice in most revolutions, most rebellions, you know, did not succeed because other Black people who were indoctrinated in slavery would turn them in. And one of the main reasons why the Haitian Revolution was successful, because as soon as the revolution began, the leaders of the Haitian Revolution said, okay, we must take care of the traitors first. So all of those people whom they thought, you know, would have the slightest inkling to turn them in to the slave masters, they got rid of them first. And that was one of the main reasons why the Haitian Revolution was successful. I mean, there are other reasons also, but that was one of the main reasons.
See, when I look at it a little bit different then. Like, I look at it like, so Toussaint Louverture, right? He had like such a discipline to his way.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't like allow for like cheating on your wife and like different things that just like kept a man focused. That, you know, certain things wouldn't happen, even though I think that he did have some type of naivete towards him. And I can't fault human as a man. And I look at, like, during the revolution or after the revolution, I look at Dasselin's way as a little bit more forward thinking. But the way that Toussaint led the force, and he picked the elite men. And you're a Marine, so you know, like, there's a difference, right? Because some men are going to be able to do it, and you can tell, you can look at them and say, okay, this dude is not meant to be here.
Yep. So the discipline was there, and the drive for freedom was there, that they said nothing would stop them.
Yes. And look at the American Revolution as especially when, because like I read a book from Thaddeus Russell, and he was talking about, you know, how, you know, there was many rebellions against slavery, but even after the Civil War, there were many slaves that wanted to go back because that's what they knew. But now, as you say, what you say about like how, you know, like those deals were made, and those agreements were made, it was more of so like a fear, and people have a fear of the unknown, right? So like what they know is what they think is best because they don't feel like they can care for themselves. And that's what causes people not to educate themselves and not to do whatever they have to do.
And that was a big part of the indoctrination. You know, once the enslaved people became indoctrinated, that's all they knew. You know, they became almost like zombies. And they were afraid even if somebody came to free them because they knew nothing else. They had the fear in them that, no. I want to stay where I am. I'm very happy where I am. Because they didn't know any better.
Right. So what's happened in Haiti, do you think? Do you think that was just Toussaint's discipline? Or because to me, Toussaint was, he was smart in a way. I feel like he trusted, you know, the other side so much. But at the same time, he felt like, okay, he looked at slavery like a level. You know, he didn't look at it like it was anything else but a level. He was like, look, once I get, like, I'm a king. Once I get out of this, nobody can tell me anything. Because he had slaves. So he was like, all right, that slavery is more of a mindset than a way of life.
Yes, I agree. But I think there was another mindset that the leaders of the revolution made sure that they got away from, because before the revolution began, Bookman, who was a voodoo priest, Bookman told them, before we even start this revolution, whatever it is that the slave masters had taught you, we need to get rid of our mind. So the first thing we need to do, the religion that they gave us, let's get that religion out of our mind because it's basically corrupting our minds. And not to say anything wrong about Christianity or any other religion, but they made sure that, listen, any religion that gave you a false image of God and of the saints, and when none of these people look like you, you need to drop that religion now. And that's what they did. And that's what the ceremony in Wakaima was all about, dropping the slave master's religion, getting rid of it because it was corrupting people's minds. Because it's that same religion that tells you, if they slap your left cheek, yep, give them the right cheek so they could slap it. But then if you're dealing with immoral people, they'll be more than happy to slap you day and night. They don't care. See, the thing was Toussaint believed in morals, and he also believed in the honor system. But unfortunately, the honor system only works with honorable people. People who enslave other people for profit, these are not honorable people. And that's why Toussaint had trusted them. He figured, okay, I'm going to sign a treaty with them. So they invited him over to go sign a treaty. And as soon as he got there, they captured him. And
I think of myself like a philosopher, like before his time, right? So the person I like in Toussaint to the most is like a JFK. I love American presidents, right? Because I just like how to, like, not that I love them, but I just love how they shape them to become this thing, right? So when I look at Toussaint, I kind of like take him like JFK. And it's something I always say in my podcast, like how, you know, there was a writer, Claire Booth, who you know, who told JFK, a great man is always one sentence, right? And he was like, you know, you're doing so much. Be present. Be one sentence. And she's like, you know, Abraham Lincoln can say he freed the slave, like whatever anyone can say, right? So when I look at Toussaint, man, like he didn't really have to do what he did. And Haiti could have been the best kept secret, right? But we know Toussaint, he has slaves. He's the only African-American in the American Constitution with the L'Ouverture Clause, all because of his cleverness, right? So when you talk about Bookman and how, you know, like his mindset changed, then you say, okay, All right, he sent his wife to America. His, you know, his wife talked to Thomas Jefferson. Whatever happened, he needed the trade to go on. What do you think made him, because he's a smart man, like, what do you think made him want to go to Europe? What made him want to go to back to France to make a deal? Or is that, or am I understanding it wrong?
I think, basically, like I said before, he believed in the honor system. And he really thought that he can actually go and sign a treaty with the French, that after everything the French went through on that island, and after beating the French so many times in the past 13 years, when the French told him, okay, well, we give up, it's time for us to sign a treaty, he actually believed them. He sincerely believed them. I guess he, you know, dropped his guard for a little bit. He believed that these were actually honorable people, but it turned out they weren't. And Dessalines had warned them. Dessalines said, do not trust them. Do not ever trust them. You know, Toussaint felt different, and he said, no, this is something that I must do so we could have peace. And he went, and they just captured him. And Dessalines was right.
So this is where my history leaves me. Like, so what happened after that? Like, when was the, was there a trial in France? Did Toussaint get tried with, you know, like the big debt that I feel like when I talk about like, not reparations, I want to call it atonement. That like, when I hear like, you know, Haitian Americans saying, oh, people owe this for slavery. And I'm like, look, if anything, the French who are like acting like they're on whoever's bandwagon, they owe me that. Because you can count me when it comes to you win a war, you lose a war. But for Haiti to be charged with these crimes that they say, quote unquote, crimes, and to still be paying a debt for those crimes and to still leave a country in shambles, for them to have the gall to come on a campaign like a BLM or whatever, after you did this for so many years to a nation, it's the craziest thing to me. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, that's how it was back then. And the Haitian people, they wanted to be recognized as a free and sovereign nation. But a few countries got together, including France, England, United States, Canada, and they said, we will never recognize you until you pay France for the revenue that they lost on that island.
Oh, wow.
And that deal wasn't made until 1825 under President Boyer. So it wasn't Toussaint or Dessalines that made that deal.
Oh.
Yep, that deal was made under Boyer just to get the recognition. They agreed, you know, to pay what I would call a ransom, basically.
Oh, wow. That's why my miseducation. I thought that it was at Toussaint's trial where that was figured out. Okay. So yeah, you did that.
But then, I mean, it could have been, because I don't have much details about the trial. I mean, it could have been mentioned back then, but that deal wasn't made until very late in 1825, which was 21 years after the revolution had ended in 1804.
So one of the most interesting things to me is, because what made me interested in just like even learning about this is when I was about to have my son, I was like, man, I don't know anything about Haiti. And so my godfather, his name is Joel, he was telling me that, you know, he came down and he was telling me like all about Haitian history while we were like, while he was helping me build my studio. And he was telling me how, you know, this is what we learned in school. And I was so naive to think that, you know, what? Like, I thought that everyone learned American history in school. You know, and it's crazy because I was born in America, you know, and I lived there for 30 plus years. I'm in the military. But it was so weird because the next time this caught me is when, like, I tried to buy some art from Haiti. And the artist was like, well, this is Dessalines. And I was like, okay, dude, I know more about Dessalines than you. And he was like, you know, he's like, I learned this in third grade. And I was like, oh, wow. But it was so crazy that, you know, because my mom's Haitian. And for me not to understand that, you know, that other countries didn't teach American history, you know, and like that was surreal to me. And then when my grandfather showed me about, you know, he was like, well, this is what happened according to his learning. And but he was around since like I want to say like in the 70s when he knew about like is it the Toto Makut, where they was like around, and he was like, yo, this dude would come around and be like, yo, you bought that girl for me. And it was like crazy. And like they would just like you and take your generator. And I was like, wow, like how did that happen? Make the long story short, like, what do you think caused the loss of like the honor system? Like, cause I feel like Toussaint Louverture, like as a male, like that, as a person, that was a very perfect place to have your value system.
Mm-hmm.
But where do you think it changed?
Yeah, I'm sure it didn't change overnight. I'm sure it took a long time before it changed, but there was a major change to 1915 in what in America they would call the Banana Wars. And of course, way back from 1899 under the Monroe Doctrine, when they had the Spanish-American War, you know, under the Monroe Doctrine, it was determined that, okay, well, they took over Cuba, they took over Philippines, took over Hawaii, you know, all of these locations that were controlled by Spain and other countries. But then in 1915, America decided, okay, well, they must go into the West Indies and basically make it their sphere of influence to make sure that no other country from Europe would take over the West Indies because it's in America's backyard. And the reason they call it the Banana Wars from 1915 to 1930, they call it the Banana Wars because that area was very fertile for the raising of bananas. At that time, the company that controlled most of the banana plantations throughout the Americas was the Chiquita Banana Company, which was eventually called United Fruit, same company. It was mainly because of them that American Marines went throughout the Americas, went throughout the Caribbean, and basically controlled it for 19 years. Now, once America left in 1934, they left in place a puppet government that would be controlled by America. And since then, it has been nothing but a successive list of puppet governments controlled by America. If any leader would ever dare to speak out against America or speak about reparations or try to do something for the people, they would be overthrown. This coup d'etat would be sponsored by overseas governments to ensure that we'd have nothing but puppet governments in Haiti from that time on. Right. So I don't think it's a problem with the people losing the honor system or losing morale, because the way things work in politics, if you need to control 6 million people, you don't need to control each and every single person. You just put your own person in charge who will do all of the dirty work for you, and your hands remain clean. So for the past, 80, 90 years or so, we've been blaming all of the successive Haitian governments. They haven't done enough. They haven't done this, but they've all been under the control of overseas governments.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, out of 6 million people, I'm saying 6 million because back then had, 5 or 6 million. Now we're up to, I believe, 9 million. You can always find, 10 or 15 people who are more than willing, to sell out their own people just for power, fame, and security. And that's what's been happening.
It's funny you say that. So I went to Haiti in 2017 for a tech conference. There was a Forbes 30 Under 30 female who happened to be Haitian, and she challenged all of the winners to go to Haiti. So, you know, I met a lot of cool people there. Like, one of the best times I ever had. It was a real easy vacation. I call it a vacation, but it was like really like a networking event. And I got to like life coach some people, and it was just really influential, like, for me, right? Because I felt like, you know, I could, you know, take over Haiti at that time I was there. Like, as I was that inspired. But I met the president, and the funny thing is, like, but I met a lot of like white Haitians, like, okay, mm-hmm. like, you know, dudes that like I wound up like hanging out with the most. And it was like really ironic because they were the only people, like, and I went down, I had my wedding ring on. They were the only people that thought that I wasn't trying to like take their girl. And like, it didn't even happen. Mm-hmm. But like all of like the young women, like, they let me coach them, whatever. And like, we worked on like, cause they would like all have proposals to Google at the time. So what they told me though was like, they were Haitian born, although they were white, they still considered themselves Haitian. And like they had, and like they were in their 20s, like lower 20s, and they had successful rum companies, right? So they would run throughout the Caribbean and South America. And like, that was their thing. And it was like, they were well off. Like, they were just there, like, hanging out, like, trying to, like, find American people to, like, sell. Hopefully, I had a bar, and it was just trying to, like, give me some rum. And I still got a couple of these guys' numbers. But the interesting thing was, what they told me was, at the port, I forget what port it was. It wasn't Port-au-Prince. It was another port. They said it would take them so long, because they were white, to get, like, what they need. They would love to have... It was kind of, it wasn't offensive to me, but it was like, they would love to have, you know, somebody like me who spoke a little bit of Creole, but enough to where I could relate to them. But even though they were mm-hmm. spoke English, but they were like, well, yep. get their product faster so they can make more rum. Because they said they mm-hmm. would win A's sometimes because of the intimidation, right? Or what they perceived as intimidation. But then, as I went to the conferences, this guy told me, he said, look, all you need is a 7-person shirt line. So he said, a sew line. He said, all you have to get is 7 people that will work 7 days a week, and you can sell shirts to America and make all the money you need. Right. And I was like, all right, let's do it. But he was like, look, it's hard for Haitians to work for Haitians. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I'm not Haitian. Then, right? Then what Renee's like, nah, you look like that. But then I didn't believe what he was saying to me, because this was like in a networking event, until that night. They said, okay, everybody that's Haitian in here, raise your hand. Everybody that's American here, raise your hand. Every Haitian, find an American and go tell them your idea, and you'll network together, and this person's going to make your life work, right? Mm. When I was doing it, these dudes that I was trying to take, they girls. I'm here trying to help you, like, figure this out, because I know I told you the other day, but I'll tell you for context for this. The biggest problem in Haiti is e-commerce, right? There's no e-commerce, zero.
Wow.
That, and there's no postal system, right? So everything is like pull and pray. You have to trust, but you know, like I know, Haiti's poor, but there's people there with money.
Right? Lots of money. Lots. Yes.
What I learned when I was there is, like, a flight from Haiti to Miami, if you have a good green card, is or visa, is $50, right? So there are people who would pay people just to go grocery shopping. You'll see people coming off the plane with groceries nowadays because they have it, right?
It's amazing, huh?
Haiti, unless you go to somebody house and they got ketchup, but that's like a sign of I'm above. And I'm mm-hmm. like, where did that start? Because I seen it the whole time I was there. I met this, and this is my last story before I know but I met this kid. He was 15 years old. He would go to Miami and spend $3,000 on sneakers because he would. These guys would like have like a pirated internet, and they would see what sneakers are coming out, and they just want to have the new sneakers, American sneakers. He would go with $3,000. He would do it for like $1 or $5. And I said, dude, you're going to die. But they don't have the internet. So they have the internet so they can see, but they can't buy.
Wow. You see?
But that keeps it like this. That keeps it up and down.
Yeah, see, I mean, with me, the last time I was in Haiti was 1999. Haven't been back to Haiti since. Because I came in 73. And the first time I went to Haiti was February 1999. I went for carnival. I spent a week. I enjoyed myself so much, and I just wanted to go back. So in August 1999, I went back for 2 weeks for what they call Fête Champêtre, which is a pretty big celebration throughout the entire country. I went to Tigouave for Fête Champêtre, which is August 15th. I was there for 2 weeks and, you know, did a little bit of traveling and realized that, wow, I mean, the place really needs help. Because me as an electrical engineer, I went to visit a plant, an electrical plant in Tigouave. The type of machines that they were still using belt and spindles, as, you know, for their generator system. I'm like, wow. And I was asking myself, what is it that the country cannot import generators? You know, regular size generators, whether it's 300 or 500 kilowatts, which is not all that big. For whatever reason, whatever the politics is, whether it's for tariffs reasons or whatever, or trade surplus reasons, they don't have enough generators.
I think it's two things. Mm-hmm. So with the regime that was there before, if you, symbolism is big, right? So I forget his name, but he made everybody bring their generator in the square and burn. So Haiti.
Now, what year was that?
I want to say it was in my grandpa, so it was in the '70s, late '70s,
right? Oh yeah, that was under Duvalier. Yeah,
Duvalier did that, right? So everybody bought the generators in the square. So this that visual is crazy, right? Then after that, till this day, the lights go off in Haiti at 8 o'clock. Right now. Right? But you have a generator. So if you have a generator, again, it's that symbolism. So people say, oh, buy a generator. So this when you're doing this, the push-pull thing, like nobody's involved. Like nobody's saying, oh wait, this is that. Cause if I know you're an electrical engineer, I'm saying, Daniel, can you send one? I'm not saying like let's build all of them.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, if you go there, it's still like a gangster ran place to where like you can't go there and say, oh, this is bad. I'm gonna do this. Because like when I was in Haiti in 2017, the news, and it reminds me so much of like the Vietnam War, right? Because like Lyndon Johnson, and like I study like what was going on in the war. The news is casted in every bar because I was going to the bar. And I was having a good time in Haiti, right? But all you hear is the news, but no context. It's just but it's extra loud. You would hear music, but then you would hear vole. Yeah, I mean, you're like, oh, man, and then they show our faces. So that fear that comes with that, and like you look at the president now, he's like a young dude, and you're like, he's a nice enough person, and I believe his heart might be in the right place. But then when you see he owns X amount of hundreds of acres of banana fields, it brings it back to what you said earlier. So,
yeah. And I think, I mean, throughout the years, we've had a lot of presidents with very good intentions, but then I guess once they get in power, they realize that there's only so much they could do. Because, I mean, a lot of times it's like running up against a wall. Problem is, if your economy depends on, you know, other countries overseas to support you, then you're basically, you know, you're endowed to them. So whatever they tell you to do, you have to do. And I think that's part of the biggest problem.
I'm going to look at Bookman because that's one name that you told me that I never really looked into. Yeah. And I'm going to look at like some of the things he said, because the same way you say about, you know, the indoctrination in the brain, and like that's what Tucson wanted to get out of, and that's what Bookman wanted to fight. This pops to me, power in that. I used to think that my uncles were just like bad men, right? My great uncles was just bad men when they just like had this fascination with women so much to where it was like, okay, you have like not even like a megalomaniac type of way, but more of a woman can't disrespect me. It was just like a ultra alpha male type of
ultra machismo.
Machismo type way. That's the perfect way. Right? But then when I saw it in 14-year-old kids, 15-year-old kids, it started to make me feel like, look, dude, I'm obviously older than you. Look at me like a threat. There's something that you were taught. These guys were giving me so many good ideas, but then as soon as a female walked by, they didn't want to talk about it.
The question is, I mean, that type of mentality, do you see it also in Black Americans? Or is it just in Haitians?
I would say this. I see it in Black Americans a lot. I pay attention to Haitians more. So when I say this, In a Black American, right, you have two types to me, as far as I'm concerned. You have a that like is like either super submissive to what he sees, and then to like his where his wife is, and I was trying to say that in the Haitians too, but then, or you have somebody that just like has a total disregard. So when a Haitian man is like this, he's going to take care, like everything has to be his. Like you could be, he got one girlfriend, two girlfriend, three girlfriend, but he's taking care of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So a Black American is like, okay, yo, give me that. Give me this. I'm taking from you. And that's something, it's more trickery. Right?
Yeah.
And so that's the difference I see. Right? But it's a mentality, but it's also like, I look at it like it's not always a bad thing, because I feel like, you know, as a man, as a king, maybe you might say, okay, I can have the kingdom and this is all mine. And this is why I'm telling you, don't mess with that. And let's get this out the way first. It might be my cybernetics that's just like, okay, it was weird to me because like, I'm coming from a capitalist society. So when somebody's talking money, I'm thinking about the money first. But they might, subconsciously, in Haiti, it might be like, oh, I'm going to pillage this whole land.
Hmm.
They might be on a different frequency than I am.
Yep.
I just don't know. And that's what makes me curious. And that's why I have this conversation with you. You see what I'm saying? Because my mom and I went in 2011, right after earthquakes. And although it was like the craziest thing I ever saw, I saw the happiest people ever. I ate the best food ever.
Yep.
I slept on the floor two nights, but it was like the best sleep ever. Nobody was worried about money. Everybody was just upbeat. Food was good. You know, I play the Chanel still to this day, and I was going to the shop by myself and doing that.
Yep.
I didn't see it like everyone else, but it kind of gave me that awakening like, oh, I'm a capitalist because I'm American and I love how we deal with things because I love to want to build, but some people like it regular.
Yeah, I mean, and at times you wonder the way, I guess, the people act, is it because of misplaced priorities? And for the guys who seem to be, it looks like their main goal is to collect women and have as many women as they can. You wonder if they're doing it, I guess, just to compensate for what they feel is a lack of their manhood. A couple of hundred years of slavery, where the man, Black man, was basically not allowed to be a man. Once slavery is over, a lot of these people, I guess, they correlate manhood with sexuality.
I can see that, but I see it different. I can see it because of, you know, like the things that happened with the Willie Lynch and all that other stuff.
Yes, the Willie Lynch letter. Yep,
I can see that in that form, but I can also hip hop music and how it's glorified, and with movements like we have now, where it's like, all right, let's big up the black woman and like let's put down the black man, to where it's like you don't know who you are, you start to feed towards your more primal sense. So it's like, all right, let me just try to control what I can control.
Yeah.
And it's like, if I can't control everything, I control nothing, then I'm going to leave. Because remember, like, I always tell my friends now, like, who doesn't take care of their kids now, right? Nowadays, right? Yeah. If you know somebody that doesn't take care of their kids, it's not my friend. I'm like, yo, dude, what are you doing? We have the means. But then you think about like what put that in place? Men were going into how like they were fighting with their wives on Fridays and Saturdays. Then they say, okay, yo, if you go to jail on Friday and Saturday, you're not gonna get out till Tuesday. Then it's like, oh, you know what? I'm not gonna go to jail. I'm gonna be easy. Or I'm not gonna go home. Right? And then it's like, okay. And then it's like, okay, if you don't go home, you can't do this. You can't drive. You can't do this. You can't do that. Or you pay child support. And then what happens? Mm-hmm. And then now it's like, okay, that's not an excuse anymore. It starts to normalize what's going on. But I'll tell you this, Haiti is the only country where domestic violence is not a crime. In this hemisphere.
Strange, right? Yeah.
That's if a government can't agree on that, that's where, you know, there has to be, like, there's a pop, and you see it now. But I'll tell you this, I have a friend who's a police officer, right? He's a Haitian.
In Haiti or here?
Yeah. And his father's like, you know, wash the bathtub for me, or wash the bathtub, something like that. And it's like that emasculation, or you don't eat until I get to the table. His father don't work. But he sees that, and it's like, come on, man. The cost of living in New York, he can't leave his mother like that. He can't leave his father like that without a house. But his father's like, he feel like his father's so naive. Because remember, see, you're successful. There's a lot of people that came to America, and even in Haiti, that just naive to it. Just like, yo, I don't care. There's going to be food on the table.
Man, we've got a whole lot to work on. You know, the mentality has to change. You know, for a lot of people, whether you're in Haiti or you're in country, if we speak about this country for, you know, black people in this country, how many of them truly understand? Like, we know, okay, we went through slavery, we had the Emancipation Proclamation, but I think part of the problem is because of the indoctrination, we've been taught very little about our own history. We learn American history, but it's been more white American history than an inclusive American history. Because I think a lot of young black people growing up, they seem to grow up with this idea that for the past few hundred years, black people never really fought hard enough to change their condition. Because that's what we've been taught in North America. There were more than 300 slave revolts. And people are like, what? Get out of here. You know, they've heard about Nat Turner. They've heard about, you know, some of them have heard about Charles Delon. Some of them have heard about the Stono Rebellion, but that's about it. But there were more than 300 slave revolts. And just recently, I had a conversation with a friend of mine, and I mentioned to him that, did you know that one of the largest slave revolts in this country was the Cherokee Rebellion, where black people who were enslaved by the Cherokee Indians escaped, more than 300 of them. It's like, what? The Indians loved us. Some of the Native Americans got along very well with black people. Black people settled with them when they escaped. But if you escaped and went to the wrong Native American nation, like the Cherokee, the Sioux, the Cree, they would enslave you just like the white people did. And the Cherokee was a very large slave-holding population.
They claim it like, oh, I'm Cherokee.
Yeah, yeah, and they're proud of it. But then how many of them actually know? And even, you know, after we speak about Charles Deland, with Nat Turner's rebellion, how many people know that Nat Turner was influenced by the Haitian Revolution? And similar, the people who escaped from the Cherokee, they were trying to make their way to Mexico. Because Mexico had abolished slavery since 1829. And interestingly enough, when Mexico abolished slavery, Texas was part of Mexico, but, you know, Americans were living in Texas with their enslaved people. And the Mexicans gave them 1 year extension for them to get rid of the enslaved people, because they said, anyone who steps foot on Mexican soil was a free person.
Right.
But they didn't listen. 1836, we hear about the Alamo. But how many people actually know what the Alamo was all about? The Alamo was about abolishing slavery. And the Mexican government gave the people in Texas three separate warnings. Said, we warned you before that slavery has been abolished in this country. If you keep these enslaved people here, we'll need to come in there and basically free them ourselves. And that's what the Alamo is all about. Mexicans went into Texas, which is their land. We're going to free these people that you keep in chains here. American history doesn't tell you that.
I think that it does, but I tell you this.
Mm-hmm.
People want like the feel-good story more than the actual story.
Yeah.
You know, like, to live in a capitalistic society, like, you have to have something, you have to get means, and you have to just
keep
doing well, right?
Yep.
That's here. Whatever else, like, you have to abide by the rules. Nobody cares that somebody else is doing something and it's infringing on your thing. Because, like, say, okay, if there's a riot going on and you have to go to school, like, what's more right now? Like, that's how, in America, that's how it is, right? But in, you know, in Canada or in Haiti, it might be different. But at the end of the day, you know, like, in 3 days, nobody's going to care about what you did, but your grade still matters, right?
Yep.
We care so much here about what, like, we think is going to make the difference because we're not used to being part of something bigger than ourselves. So we don't put ourselves as big as we can be, you know, as far as like, I feel like as far as Black people here. But then when you start to like look at that and you say, okay, why couldn't I do this? Why couldn't I do that? And then you say that I can and I should, and then you start to do it. It's a little bit different. But I think that so many caught in the, think about it. Who do like most Black Americans look up to? It's all entertainers. And, like, that's not going to get you anywhere, right? Because, like, that's, like, one in a billion.
Yes.
Right? And then so then you say to yourself, okay, if I can't be this, the next best thing is, like, an entrepreneur but I'm a drug dealer first or I'm this first. But it's, like, that's not how it works. Nobody tells you, you know? And I was talking to my mom today about it. She's like, well, I was like, yo, I look for so many people to help me with my audio. So, and I was like, you know, she's like, well, maybe they're not telling you. I'm like, no, no, maybe they don't know. Because people come and, like, they touch the things and they do what they can do for me and they try. And I'm like, well, to be a learner and to be a leader is different. Like, some people guess things and it works for them and they leave it the same. But to be able to know something that's, like, somebody can put their own insurance by, that's And that's why we get so many, you know, one in a million people, because people work hard and they get it, but they can't pass it on.
Yeah. Yeah, good point.
You know, I always tell my father, I'm like, hey, like, what you teach me? You know what I mean? It's like little things, but it's never like anything like, well, oh, I taught you how to like balance a checkbook, or I taught you how to do like practical things. So it's like, okay, as an adult, I'm learning that on my own. I don't blame him. I'm just saying that, like, if you look at it, that's what it is, right? It's just that. Like, life is so fast, you don't realize what your parents don't teach you, because it's like, all right, just go to school, go do this, go do that. It's not like, how'd you do it?
Do you think throughout the ages, a lot of our parents have basically taught us how to live in this capitalist system? Or have they taught us basically how to live as Black people who want to be part of this capitalist system?
My parents never raised me like that. So, like, my mom always raised me like, look, you could do whatever you want to do, right? So you can do whatever you want to do. I seen it like, okay, if you Black, this is what's going to happen. But I always looked at it like, if you show me the rules, like, that's what it was. And even if somebody, it was equal, whatever, I never looked at anything. Like, I always knew I had to work harder. That's how last time my mom showed me, but she never showed me, like, to go into anything with fear.
And I think you're one of the lucky ones. You're one of the lucky ones, because unfortunately, I think a lot of our people have been so discouraged. A lot of that discouragement came from their upbringing, where they grew up with a lot of parents that were so frustrated themselves, didn't know exactly where they're going, that they're passing the frustration to their kids.
When I grew up Haitian, it wasn't easy. It was like, even like to admit that you was Haitian. But I saw change. You know what I mean?
I know it well. Yep.
Yeah. I was born in America, but ever since my uncles and everybody that were in America, I've never seen like poverty. My wife is white. And like stuff she talk about how she grew up, I'm like, man, I wish more people heard that story, because we never, like, in a Haitian house, you could have friends over and it would never be like, oh, they gotta go home because we gotta eat. It was never like, right? Because you could always, there's always enough soft spot for everybody.
Yes, so, always.
Like that. So my mindset was different. I was like, yo, people just making fun of us because they don't know us. But it was like, we ate dinner every night. Like, so to me, like, Haitians are, we were always conservative into where we would keep it in the house. We would never disrespect police. That, like, to me, like, that stuff started happening in late 2010s after that. But we would never, like, tell people they had to go home because we couldn't eat. Like,
no.
If my mother or my grandmother gave somebody money, gave me money, they would just give my friends the money, too. Yes. So I don't know where, like, this whole, like, impoverished Haitian came from. But it started.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Everybody in Haiti wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. Like, when I got married in Costa Rica, and it just happened to be the week of this top 100 Haitian convention. This brother right here, we wound up connecting, and you know, we started in the country.
Wow. You know?
That's my whole thing about this. It's like, you know, he's there, he's successful, his fault, like, he was there like three generations in, Haitians. And it was like 100 Haitians there. So I was like, okay, I'm just lucky to be here. But I connected with these people. And it was like, okay, he was like, oh, brother, you saw that on the airplane. I'm gonna send you an autographed copy so you can show your friends. And he was just like, talk about it.
Yep. Wow. See, now, how did it make you feel to meet people like that? Didn't it uplift you when you met that doctor and those other, you know, 100 Haitian people? I mean, wasn't that an uplifting feeling? Don't you think that if more young people would have that kind of experience and meet these people, do you think it would change their outlook on life?
Hey, I can't say it would, because I tell you this, man, like, I know you, right? And you're an engineer. So, like, I don't really meet, like, irresponsible, like, bad Haitians. So, like, that's what they teach us. But, like, every time I meet somebody that's Haitian that's older, like, of course, you're going to have your outliers, but
yeah,
that to me. You know what I mean? Well, maybe, and maybe I'm lucky, like you said, like, okay, I got to meet 100 successful Haitians, doctors, lawyers, and everything. And I know an engineer, but to me, that's everybody. I know an engineer that's, you know, that's texting me about basketball right now.
Yeah.
He's Haitian. And he went to, you know, went to Holy Cross. He went to St. John's. It's the same thing. So, you know, and I'm best friends with his cousin. So it's just like, I don't know. You know, sometimes you think about like what people tell you people are, but I just don't know it like that. Like for somebody to say, oh, Haitians is this. Like when people used to tell me when I was little, like, oh, Haitians is dirty. I was like, all right, what are you talking about? Because my grandfather drove a Porsche and your father's but I don't know. Maybe I'm spoiled or whatever, or I'm this or that or third, but I'm like, it's like, look, your mother's cooking out a bag. My mother makes juice call out bar every night. Like, my mother cooks every night. What are you talking about?
I think for a lot of people, whether you're Haitian or Black American, the upbringing makes a real big difference, because the drive that you have, just imagine if you grew up with parents, uncles, and aunts who did nothing but discourage you. Every time you had an idea that, oh, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that. But if you grew up with people discouraging you, your life could have been so different right now. But I'm pretty sure as you are growing up, like you said, your mom told you, hey, you could be whomever you want. You could do whatever you want. Let nobody stand in your way. So it really makes a big difference. But I think, unfortunately, for a lot of us, whether you're Haitian, whether you're Black American, unfortunately, for a lot of us, we had parents who only knew about struggle in their lives. A lot of them were not too educated. A lot of them, all they knew, they just knew how to struggle. And unfortunately, the way they express themselves with their young children, you know, has a long-lasting effect on them. Imagine growing up with a mother who tell you, ah, you're no good. You're just like your father. You're going to turn out just like your dad. You end up, and unfortunately, a lot of people grow up in these circumstances and they sort of grow up messed up.
Oh, you're right. I think, and now that you say that, I kind of empathize with it to the point that, like, I feel like, you know, this is the best time in the world right now, right? And I say this. My mom might have went through that, and that's why she was so adamant about not having me go through that, right?
Yep, to make sure you have a better life than she did, yeah.
So my uncles would tell me stories about how, like, my grandfather, you know, changed alarms when he was in America. I couldn't picture my grandfather doing that because he was such a G. Like, he was such a prominent person. I couldn't even picture him doing going under somebody's car. You see what I'm saying? But that's my perception, because that now I see the image and what he wanted me to see. A Porsche, and he had a BMW. He had cars. So I never thought about him going, changing the alarm. Him? What? My uncle told me that. I thought he was lying. You know what I'm saying? So, but now, I never look at it like, I never want my son to see a hard day. You know what I mean? And I think that's wrong. Like, my son thinks that he could stand on top of cars with his golf club. He's two. That's what I want him to feel like. You see what I'm saying? So,
yeah,
I'm saying is 100% right. But I think that is growth. Like this, with age comes maturity. So I feel like if you stuck in the past, and I think that, like, at least from a Black American side, and I haven't seen it, and I'm Black, I'm half Black, half Asian. So when I see like Black American side, there's a lack of growth, right? And there's a lack of growth for some Haitians, but in my family, I don't see it. I've never seen it. On my Black American side, it's always like, look, I'm going to pay the mortgage, I'm going to pay the bills, But the entrepreneurship side of it kind of lacks a little bit. But that's what it is. It's like, all right, we got a good job. They gave us a job. We're going to do the job.
But do you think it's because a lot of people have been discouraged?
Right. Yeah.
Daniel,
thank you very much. And I love this conversation, and we need to have conversations like this more. So I appreciate
it. Let me know. It was good talking to you, man.
Of course.